Yeah, what I'll do is use this as a test, so we'll replay it just to see. So we need to ask you to check the box which you choose, which you said is number one.
This is
Mr. Vieira.
Okay.
Would you like to get that?
I think my wife, Elena? She's in the room. Just check the box.
Check that, and then, and on this one if you could.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Thank you. And then there's a place for you to sign.
Do I initial it here, or?
Initial it, yes, please. Excellent. And then I need to ask you to sign here and on that one as well.
Sign.
So your signature number 7.
Just sign
there.
Just a side of it here or
yes,
something?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm. And on that one as well, the next page. And there's one other signature that I need from you. And that's on the next page.
Where it says subject?
Yeah. And a date if you could. I think it's August, is it August 13th?
12th.
12th.
Tomorrow's the 13th, Friday the 13th?
Uh-huh. And I'm going to start at the beginning, and that is ask you a little bit about your parents, your family, where you grew up, and the description of your family, brothers and sisters, and so forth. So could you help me with that?
Okay, first of all, let's see. I grew up in East Boston. I have 2 sisters, no brothers. Just an average American family. Naturally, I'm 70 years old, so we're going back to 1934 when I was born. And my mother and father were. My father was a longshoreman and a worker on a truck. My mother was just a housewife. And hemophilia, it came from her side of the family, which I don't know too much about. I think it was one of her brothers or someone had it. She was Irish. My Vieira is Portuguese. They didn't know too much about it because we're going back to, 35s, 40s, which nobody knew too much about it, you know?
Right.
And just kind of dealt with it as far as basically don't do anything, in a sense, because you didn't want to get a bleed or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So they were aware that it was a possibility?
Yes, I believe so. Like I say, it's such a long time ago and nobody really probably knew too much about it, but she had a brother, I think it was a brother who had the disease, but I believe they were aware of it. Well, they weren't until I guess we got diagnosed, probably that's another thing. I had a couple of problems growing up as a kid, cutting my finger and different bleeds, and they took me to a doctor at the old Boston City Hospital.
And how old were you when they
I was about 6, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In that first 6 years, different things had happened or something, here and there. And I'm not sure if they could figure it out or they thought or what, because I don't think anybody knew too much about it,
No.
And his name was Damashek, I think.
Dr. Damashek.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's an old timer, and he diagnosed it as, hemophilia. Later on, I don't know if he moved on, but I used to see a doctor there at the hospital. His name was Bigelow, Frederick Bigelow. He was another doctor. But then they knew I had it, and since they knew I had it then, they basically didn't want me to do too much, like play sports or be very careful. And at that time, it was a case of when you bled, they more or less just, as you bled, they kind of replaced the blood. They didn't have too many things like factor VIII or anything that we have today or any kind of stuff that would help it. It was kind of crude, but that was all they knew about it.
Were you aware of any other patients at that center being treated for the same thing?
No.
So you were the only person you knew, and your parents, didn't have support, they didn't have other people.
No, I'm sure there were, but back then, we didn't know of any. And as far as support groups, no, I don't even know if there was any or anything like that, because like I say, 70 years ago, it was kind of a, I never want to say hidden, it was a disease that nobody knew much about, and people just didn't support or do anything about it, you know.
How much do you remember about that period? You were six. Mm-hmm. How much do you remember about being diagnosed and the way your life changed as a result of that?
Well, basically my life changed in the fact that I just kind of had to be very careful about whatever I did, and of course my mother and father were very cautious about me not doing anything. Other than that, it was just, I tried to lead a normal life, but people didn't, also, it was very, we didn't disclose it to anybody, because at that time, when people, they used to call them bleeders, hemophilia, I don't know if people even knew what it was then, you know, they'd say a bleeder. People thought when you called a bleeder, you were going to get a cut or something, you'd bleed all over them or something. So it wasn't too public then. I tried to keep it under the table, and I mean, if it came up and someone had inquired about it, which most people wouldn't, other than doctors or something like that, you know, it was a disease that you kind of it was hidden.
Mm-hmm. And would you say your parents were overprotective, or were they
overprotective?
They were.
Yeah.
Would you say that was true of both your parents?
Yeah, only because of their knowledge that they didn't know much about the disease, mm-hmm. which nobody did. So it was like try to keep them in a bubble or something. Mm-hmm. But
did you have much of an extended family at that time? Grandparents, aunts and uncles?
Yes. My
cousins?
Back then, yeah, I had cousins and aunts and uncles, and yeah, they were all living it back then.
And they were all, you had a supportive network then?
Yeah, I believe, you know, they were there to help me if I needed it, but they didn't know much about it either, so, you know, it wasn't
But they
much.
All knew.
They all knew, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but you had a big relatively big nuclear family.
Yeah, I had that grand. My father's mother and father were living. My mother's parents had died. Her brothers and sisters were gone. My father had sisters and brothers, and they were all around. And cousins, yeah, plenty of cousins and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm.
And had you started school when you were diagnosed?
I started, yeah, at, I guess, first grade, you know, mm-hmm. Basically, you know, five or six, whatever it was back then, you know.
And how did that school experience go?
We didn't tell them, nobody told anybody, but it went okay, other than when I'd get bumps and bruises or cuts, I'd lose time from school and stuff like that.
But basically, your peers at school didn't know?
No.
And you managed to keep that
hidden from them, yeah.
What about the teachers?
They didn't know.
They didn't know?
No.
That was not risky, but if something had happened to you, there was really no one at school who knew what was going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you were presumably highly educated. They educated you so that you would know what to do if something.
Well, I knew, I don't know if you say highly educated, but I knew basics of it. Back then, though, nobody that would disclose anything. As of today, when a child has some kind of a disease, I know they tell teachers, and are they supposed to? Because my daughter's a teacher, my son-in-law's a teacher, my son's a teacher, and you know, things are a lot different. I never disclosed anything to my employers. I mean, I found that if it came up to that point, I would question, you know, I would tell them, but it was always fear of your job, losing your job because of that, which they say you can't. Nobody disclosed anything back then because mm-hmm. nobody knew much about it, you know. Mm-hmm. So if it came up, if you weren't confronted with it, you'd have to tell them, but basically you told nobody anything.
Tell me about the earliest you can remember about the care system and what the doctors were like and how you felt about what was happening to you physically. Was it really disturbing? You had a lot of shots and transfusions.
When you say the care system, you mean?
Oh, the hospital and the doctors.
Well, my first experience, basically my first experiences, were at the City Hospital in Boston. It was for cuts and stuff that I had and extraction of teeth and stuff like that. The knowledge was as good as they could do then. Most resident doctors or anybody else knew nothing about the disease. I mean, when they would come in to see me, they would look at me, and I don't know if they expected to see a basket case or what, but, you know, they would say, they'd look at the chart once, and they'd say, this is Matthew, and then, I mean, I knew what they were looking at, you know, I mean, they knew nothing about it, and they would ask me the same questions over and over again, you know, like, you know, who had it, when did you know you had it, you know, repetitive questions, which sometimes were a pain in the neck, but I knew why they were asking, because none of them knew anything about it. It was mm-hmm. The care was the best, I guess, they had. Later on, we moved on to New England Medical Center with Peter Levine in
Boston. How old would you have been when you made that move?
That was, actually when I was in my 30s or 40s, because mm-hmm. we were going to Boston City. We moved on to him, and then he moved on to Worcester, so we went out to Worcester with him. Of course, when I was 30, that would be, the 60s or so. There was a little more knowledge of the disease, but still not a great, great amount of it, mm-hmm. you know. And since I've moved from Worcester back into Boston to the Brigham and Women's, and of course, now there's a lot more knowledge. And
much easier, isn't it?
Yeah, people today, if you say you're a hemophilia, they know what you are because they see it on the news, they read it in the paper, they know it's a bleeding disease. Some of them don't know how it's treated and stuff like that, but it is treated much better now because these mm-hmm. kids have all kinds of factors and stuff that they can live almost a normal life, which mm-hmm. basically I couldn't at the time. You know, I had to be very, very careful because it was just a matter of trying to treat the blood as it, you know, there were different variations. There was cryos they had at one time and stuff. No, it's a lot easier now for mm-hmm. people.
Were you taught to transfuse? Were your parents taught to transfuse?
No.
So whenever you had an incident, you needed to go into Boston City?
Yes, because there was nothing to transfuse at the time. I mean, it was just up until I got the factor VIII and stuff, all the things were basically done at a hospital or whatever, you know, because nobody knew about self-infusion or anything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean.
And how often would you say in those early years you found yourself going to the hospital?
In a rough, that's such a long time ago, quite often. I mean, I would say quite often in my earliest years, mm-hmm. up until maybe the 30s or so, the 40s, say mm-hmm. 30s or 40s. I guess I got a little smarter and more cautious. Most of my problems growing up were trying to play sports and, doing stupid things. Also, a lot of times, I may not have to go into a treatment center. I might hurt an ankle or a knee or something, and I would just have to stay home for a couple of weeks or something and elevate it and put ice on it and stuff like that because mm-hmm. there wasn't anything else at the time. You couldn't infuse. I mean, now, if you bump something, you're supposed to infuse and, you know, rest it a little bit, but also you can be active on it. Back then, it was just get off your feet, put ice on it, elevate it, stuff like that. You know?
How would you say overall it affected your school experience? Did you feel that you could really participate, or did you feel different somehow? Do you feel you missed some of your school experience?
Not so much in the school experience itself, because I never was that type of person that wanted to participate in a lot of things. As far as sports, I couldn't get involved with any sports or anything because I would have to disclose what my problems and this and that. And naturally, at that time, I'm sure they would have said no, period, you know. But as far as my general education and stuff, I don't think it impaired me any.
Mm-hmm. And did you, as we do when we're growing up, did you formulate ideas about what you wanted to do? Did you think ahead and think about your profession and start to develop your life?
Not really, no. No, I mean, I just felt I was going to go to grade school and high school. I had no intentions of going on to college. Maybe at one time I felt I might want to go to a technical school or something, become a... I guess photographer. At one time I was hooked up with photography, and there was a Wentworth Institute in Boston I thought I might go get into something like that, but no, there was that was just something, if it happened, it happened, and it didn't, and mm-hmm. I just went on and took what came along, you know.
Mm-hmm. What about economically? Did it affect your family economically, all of the hospital? I mean, I understand that in the 30s it was very mm-hmm. different, but was that a point of strain at all?
I don't think so. I really forget if my father or mother had hospitalization insurance or anything. They probably did, but I don't recall them ever complaining about it or anything, but we might have been getting free care too or something, I don't know.
It was very different then, yeah. And of course mm-hmm. Boston City may well have been free. And your sisters are older than you are?
One's older and one's younger.
So, well, you were diagnosed at age 6, so did they, I wondered if that affected their decision to have children.
Well, my oldest sister, she can't have children, so, and she's a couple of years older than me now, so she has no chance. She never had any. My younger sister has a son. I don't think it really affected her, and there's no problem with him or nothing. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it affected them, basically. You know.
But what about your parents? Do you think that affected their decision to have more children?
I don't really know, but I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think the three of us was plenty, I think, you know.
Right. You were a handful.
Well, no, but, you know, if like I was born in 34, my sister was born in 32, my other sister was 38. So let's see, 38, my parents, you know, they were in their 30s, I guess, by then mm-hmm. or something. I don't think, you know, they were planning on any more children, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because basically you know, they had one girl, one boy, and one girl, so I don't really think it affected them, you know.
May I ask what their religious affiliation was?
Catholic.
Mm-hmm. And you were also, of course, Catholic.
Yeah, Catholic, but I go to a Greater Grace Church now. I'm not too involved with Catholic Church right now. I'm mm-hmm. with a born-again Christian group.
Is there anything, of course there are things that, given everything we know now, that you would wish could have been different when you were younger, but looking back, apart from non-participation in sports and so forth, was there anything that strikes you that you wish had been different? For example, the overprotectiveness.
Yeah, you don't mean, naturally I wish I didn't have the disease.
No, but, I understand, yeah. But given the disease.
Yeah. Yes, I wish they had known more about it, but you know, it's such a long time ago. Yeah, I wouldn't want people to be overprotective, and also I wish we knew more about the disease at the time, or they had stuff that they had today, mm-hmm. medicines they had today, but that's something that'll have to be in my next life or something like that.
What was the first innovation that really affected you, the first medical innovation in terms of hemophilia research that really impacted you and made it much easier for you?
Let's see. I guess the cryos were the cryos, you know, when they had cryoprecipitates, that was sort of a step up. But I guess the best thing that happened in the whole thing was learning to get factor VIII and self-infusion and stuff like that. And the idea that we could have operations and things if we needed them with no problems or anything, you know.
Excuse me, milk is fine, just milk.
Yeah, I guess basically that, because prior to that, they really never thought about operations or anything like that mm-hmm. Because of the amount of blood involved and stuff like that and everything. Mm-hmm. But once that came along, I mean, they don't.
And how old were you when that came along?
Gee, the fact is, must have been about the 80s, I guess. I'd say roughly in the 80s.
When you were in your 50s.
Yes. And that was a big factor about the time about the people getting HIV, the viruses and everything, because most of the stuff then was tainted and everything, you know, at the time. Fortunately, I never got AIDS. I had hepatitis C, but I went on a program about 2 years ago and got cured with that. But I've never had AIDS. I was one of the lucky ones. That was, so it was back around this, it was 70s, 80s when the Factor came out, which was a great, great, great thing for everybody because you could infuse yourself. I didn't because I didn't learn to infuse. It's not even 10 years ago, but my wife used to always infuse me, you know. But it was there for people to use. That was the biggest innovation, you know.
Wait, that must have been quite a day.
Yeah, because you didn't have to no longer go to a medical center or a hospital. I mean, you'd call them up and you'd tell them you had a bleed, this or that, and they'd tell you, well, you know, infuse, you know, because we'd send to the different places and get like Caremark happens to be mine, get stuff, which I stored downstairs. We'd have needles and syringes, and she'd infuse me, or I'd infuse myself. And maybe take it easy for a day or so, and then keep in touch with them. You didn't have to keep running back and forth.
Do you remember, as the news about the tainted blood began to emerge, that must have been a hard time?
Yeah, naturally I was a little worried about it. I don't think I was too worried about it, because I was one of those people that never infused probably when I should have. That's why I have a bad knee and a bad ankle. From constant bleeds in them and stuff, you know, and it's killed the cartilages and stuff like that. If I was to come back in life, my next life, I'll know enough to infuse. And that was one of the things they always used to tell me, when in doubt, infuse, which I never did. They were saying, you know, if you've got a little pain or a twinge, infuse.
They said that even in the early stages.
Even in the early stage, always infuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not going to hurt that when you could infuse, I say. When it was blood that we got, you'd have to go to the hospital or
mm-hmm.
something like that and have
right.
them give it to you. But the reason they were saying that was because it's not going to hurt you. You're going to infuse all you want. It won't harm you. It's just going to go in and make your blood healthier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So infuse, you know, doesn't matter. I never got to that point. I'm better now today, but a lot of the things I have are injuries that are going to be there. Event, you know, it can't help them any, you know. So
do you think some of that probably had to do with the fact that to get a transfusion, you have to literally go to the hospital?
Yes, and I think some of what I was thinking of at the time was insurance and when you know how much insurance you have, like $2 million or whatever it is. What's the word I'm thinking of?
Health insurance.
Yeah, what's it? Your cap.
Yeah.
It's I was always thinking of, you know, that I'm going to use up my cap or something, which I can never use up in a million years because. You know, if you got $1 million, I mean, these young kids today, yes, because if they start at a smaller age, like say at 5, 10 years old, by the time they reach my age, they might have gone over their cap, or they would have to recap or get new insurance. I would never have gone over my cap at the time. I never will now. So it's got to do with insurance, and it was got to do with going back and forth to the hospital. You know,
when you were young, in school. It must have had to do with taking the time out. But you said you'd elevate your leg, stay home for a couple of
weeks. Yeah, I'd be out of school periodically here and there, you know, constantly,
mm-hmm.
you know. And naturally, when I went back, they'd say, what happened? I'd say, oh, I bruised my leg or something like
mm-hmm.
that. I would never say I got a bleed in my leg or something, you know.
Yeah.
You get your way through it and stuff like that. But, it's probably one of the reasons, like I say, I never did infuse that much. But all you needed was one. I just happened to be lucky enough not to get it. You know? There was one time that Dr. Levine called and said, that they had received a notice or something that there was a bad batch of Factor VIII or something like that. And fortunately, I didn't have that batch anyways. I didn't get it or something, so it was no problem. But other than that, I never really thought about it. And then after the... say the middle 80s and everything, then they went to the heat treated, and supposedly today there's no problem with any of it, you know, so.
That was just roulette, wasn't it?
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In that little period, that window of time.
Yeah, but an awful lot of people, you know, got AIDS and stuff like that.
Yes, they did.
And, you know, I guess it's something that basically could have been dealt with better. I mean, I know they claim that the drug companies knew about a lot of this. Whether they did or not, they might have. I mean, I know drug companies make an awful lot of money. I mean, just with general medicines today, prescriptions and stuff are unbelievable. Whether they knew and didn't want to do anything about it, who's to say? It's all politics, I guess. But
did you follow it very closely?
Not that close. I mean, I've, you know, kept a little bit here, a little bit there, and what I heard through the groups and the hemophilia and stuff. I guess probably because I wasn't affected with it. Maybe that said to myself, well, I feel awful bad for everybody, but it's not my problem, you know, or it's not me. But
it's not you.
Which wasn't probably right, but...
Well, you have your own.
Well, I think it's like a lot of things. Even today, we find that in these groups and everything we go along with, a lot of the young mothers and everybody, nobody gets too involved with anything until it affects them personally, you know. Like I guess everything in life, you don't get involved until it affects you personally, you know.
I think that's true. Mm. Tell me about the groups. When did you start participating in groups?
I believe we got involved with the New England Hemophilia about, that's got to be 20 years ago or so, maybe 25, you know, through going to New England Medical Center and finding out that there was a hemophilia association and stuff like that. And there is, I don't know if you're familiar with them, they had their office in Dedham there. We go out to Dedham and we volunteer a lot because I'm retired now and my wife works part-time. We'll go out and help them do mailings or stuff, that they, you know, clerical work, or they even come here, bring the mailings here, and we do them here, you know. We're pretty much involved with them when they have any kind of events or anything. We kind of try to help them with other people and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's been about, I'd say, 25 years ago, which would have been, about the 80s or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you join groups where you talked with other people who had...
My wife went to a bunch of teas and stuff like that, and we used to go to all any seminars or anything that they had, you know. Mm-hmm. And if people ask questions, we try to help them. But as far as actual joining, I don't think there was any like membership or joining. It was just, you know, they had different things going on, and you would attend or you wouldn't attend.
Yes, but not support groups where you'd go and sit with other men and talk about your experiences and so forth?
They had a few, and if they were there and we were available, we'd go and talk to them, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so we graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you do?
I went to Newman Preparatory School in Boston for about 6 months or so, and then for some reason I just left. I just went on to work. I think most of my early jobs were just like doing clerical work or shipping and receiving and stuff like that. And and then eventually I got into truck driving, and I drove truck for like 40, 45 years, you know, for different outfits and stuff. You know?
Mm-hmm. Long distance?
No, just within the state, you know, mm-hmm. Well, within New England states.
Mm-hmm. And you did not reveal your hemophilia?
Not to anybody, no.
Did it ever pose an issue for you in your work life?
No. I mean, I did have to, like I say, take time off here and there, but I always managed to, you know, say this happened, that happened, whatever. But no, it never came to a problem where I actually got a bleed or a cut or anything right there at work or anything like that I was involved with that. I might have bruised a leg or something, and I kind of limped through the day and then came home or something like that. But yeah, I never got any serious wounds or cuts or accidents that I had to deal with right on the job.
As you say, you probably become very canny about how to take care of yourself.
Yeah, you kind of, I guess you learn to deal with situations and things, and you learn to, you know, kind of get through things, you know. Like, well, I remember one time someone said, don't say that you have hemophilia, just say you have a factor VIII deficiency, you know, which sounds a little better. It means the same thing, but when you tell someone that, it kind of stumps them and they don't ask any more questions. They don't really know what it is, I don't think, but it suffices them anyways. If you said to them, I have hemophilia, you know, which is a factor VIII deficiency or a factor IX of it, mm-hmm. I mean, they, all kinds of whistles would go off and they'd start asking questions, you know.
That's a very interesting thing, because it's true.
Yeah, that's all it is a factor. I'm not lying, it's a factor VIII deficiency. Mm-hmm. It's just I'm using my terminology rather than saying what it actually is, you know.
Were there questions surrounding your choice to get married and have children?
Not really. There might have been a minor, but not really. You know, it wasn't a big issue.
Was that something your parents talked about with you, or again, was there so little information that basically?
There was so little information, and I think my mother had. I don't know if my mother or father. One of them. My mother, I think, passed away. My father was still living, I think. But it was never really entered the issue. I don't know if it was that big a factor at that time. I think it's a lot more today. When like my daughter is a carrier, and when she had a child, it happens to be a girl. It was an issue of, you know, whether it would be a boy and be a, she could be 50% chance he would be a hemophilia, 50 he wasn't, you know, and they chose, you know, to find out if it was a boy or a girl. It was a girl, so if it was a boy, I don't know if they just would have, you know, went along with it or what, but it would never, I think it's more today than it was in my era, because I've been married 35 years or so, you know, so.
Did the doctors talk to you about the implications of getting married and having children?
No.
They never brought
Not in a big issue. They might have brought up the fact that there is that possibility, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that in my going back, 40 years ago would be what, 62, back around the 60s or so. I don't think it was as big as it was, say. They might have said, you know, possibly when you get married, there could be this or that, but it wasn't a real big, I don't think, issue.
You know? Wasn't something you struggled with?
No.
And you met Eleanor
mm-hmm.
when you were how old?
Oh, well, I was in my 30s, I guess. Actually, I was married twice. My first wife, who I have a son by, that's my older grandchildren. That was back about 60, 61 or 2, somewhere back then. And there was really no big issue with that. And then I remarried again in 68 to Eleanor. And I was, well, at that, let's see, 62, I would have been 34 or 28 or so, and then another, I was in my 30s when I married Eleanor, so there was no real big issue, mm-hmm. in fact, because maybe we didn't know that much about it, too, you know, because
mm-hmm.
it was just after we got married and stuff that we started to get more interested with Eleanor. With more interested with Peter Levine and with New England Hemophilia Association to find out more about my disease. Prior to that, I was just kind of like, well, I have it and just forget about it. It's there, it's there. But she was interested, and she more or less encouraged me to learn more about it and deal with it better, you know, because it was going to be whoever we had children and stuff like that. It was going to affect everybody, you know.
Of course. Your first wife, you told her, but it was not a big issue for her.
Yeah, not a real big issue.
And she wasn't proactive in the sense that she didn't pursue it or want to know more about it.
No.
You had your son.
Mm-hmm.
And was he tested?
I don't really even know if he was. I think he has a mild, as of now, I mean, that we just know, he has a mild case of von Willebrand's disease, but he doesn't have hemophilia. His daughters have, he has two girls and a boy. They have a mild case of von Willebrand's, which has nothing to do with me. We went through this, you know. Some hemophiliacs have both hemophilia. I only have the hemophilia. It always came up naturally that, you know, it's my fault because, you know, they get the, but it isn't. We diagnosed this with my people in Worcester and everybody, and it's a genetic disease or something that has nothing to do with me. They have it, and they got it from either my wife's side or the mother's side or whatever it is, you know, or something like that.
When it came up, when they discovered they had that, did you feel that they were disturbed with you? Was that?
Not disturbed, but I think like anything, they might have, you know, someone was trying to put the blame on someone, you know, you know, saying, not in a real vicious way, but, you know, they did kind of say, you know, it's Maddie's fault or something like that, you know, but not in a vicious way. You know.
No. But that's our nature, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. But now they realize that it had nothing to do with me, so,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And they were fully informed, presumably, your son when he married. And
yes, yeah.
So he knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then you remarried, and Eleanor was much more proactive. She
right.
wanted to know more about it. But
mm-hmm.
when you told her that you had it, she presumably accepted that without any problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there a discussion around whether to have children?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
You just decided?
I think also because we didn't know that much about it at the time, too. It was because of our, not knowing, ignorance of the knowledge and stuff like that.
Ignorance was bliss.
Ignorance, yeah. Like they say, ignorance, you know, of knowledge and different things is bliss, you know. I think we didn't really understand or know too much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we went ahead, and then we found out, we kind of got more educated on what's what, you know.
Were you surprised once you began to self-educate? Were you surprised at some of the things you learned?
Yeah, because, you know, I just kind of knew the basics, but no, I, you know, got more interested in it because,
mm-hmm.
like I say, I had the disease and now I was trying to find out more about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain things still about the disease that I don't know, and, you know, I'm at that point, I guess, in my life where I probably know as much as I'll ever know or want to know, and I can handle it and everything, you know. Maybe the younger children today want to know more about it, but then again, I don't know if they really do because of the way they're able to handle it a lot better than I was with all the new things out there and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. And then hopefully, I don't think it'll ever happen at my age, but they're talking about, you know, gene therapy where someday it may not be there, you know,
mm-hmm.
but hopefully it won't, you know.
Well, hopefully it won't.
Yeah.
It'll be one of the things people used to have.
Yeah, and then they'll say, well, then they'll forget about it, then because they'll have cured it, see, and then another disease will come along, you know, but,
mm-hmm.
but it'll help someone, you know.
Do you counsel or talk to to people who are recently diagnosed? Do you work, do you ever work for them?
No, I only if I go to a meeting or something, like a tea, tea's with my
mm-hmm.
wife, but only if they have some kind of a different people have groups and New England Hemophilia might have different seminars and things like that. I go to them and I'll talk to them, you know, if they would like me to, or if someone asks me a question. I don't usually get up and be a public speaker.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest part I find is they're trying to convince these young kids, young people today, about like basically what I went through from having nothing to where they are today. You know, it's like me saying, you know, you know, you don't know how hard it was when there was a kid growing up, and we didn't have television, we didn't have this and stuff like that. You know, they don't want to hear that stuff, you know. I mean, all they want to do is know what's going on today. And I say, you guys are so lucky to have this here. I think they still resent the fact that they had the disease, which that'll never come about. But it's a lot easier to handle today mm-hmm. than it was when I was a kid. I try to help them as much as I can, you know.
And it's a lot safer.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How has it affected your overall health? You say that you have pains in your joints and your...
My overall health? I think I'm fairly healthy,
mm-hmm.
you know, other than I have a bad left ankle, a bad knee. The right ankle is pretty good. My other joints are basic. Other than my general health, I think I have really no problem. I mean, as far as, I see a regular pediatrician. I go to see my hemophilia doctor. I was in trucking business for like 45 years. I mean, I don't get too many colds that I find. Last time I was hospitalized, I can't remember. I've gotten more careful, I guess, as I went along. But my general health is in pretty good condition. I have high blood pressure, but I take a pill for that. I take vitamins. I
mm-hmm.
try to exercise. I try to keep my weight down. You know?
Presumably, you never had to have surgery. As a child?
The only surgery I ever had as a child was extraction of teeth. And that was a holocaust because...
How old were you, say, when that first occurred?
Oh, I would say back in my teens or something like that, you know, which would have been in the 40s or so, you know.
Can you describe that experience? How did you handle it? What happened?
Well, what they would do is basically, first of all, back then, I guess, my parents never sent me to the dentist that often or something. I guess we weren't big dentist freaks or anything, which a lot of people were. Today we are. I mean, I go to the dentist all the time and everything, you know, every 6 months and everything, you know. And naturally my teeth decayed or whatever and stuff like that. And I had to have some teeth extracted. It was, I don't know if it was like, well, back then they would probably only take out a couple of teeth at a time too, because they were very leery about doing it, and then they only would take so many out, you know, because right. They want to get involved. What they would do would be, they would put you in the hospital and you would...
Of the hemophilia.
Yeah, and they would give you pints of blood, the whole blood. You know, you'd either have to have people come in and donate blood for you, or they'd take it from the blood bank and then they would replenish you and stuff like that. They would fill you up with blood, how many pints, I don't know, before the surgery. Then they would do the surgery with the one or two teeth, whatever it was. And they used to, they would pack it with a thing. I thought they called it an oxycell or something like that, which is supposed to be some kind of a coagulant or something. They would put like a mouth, they would take a impression of your teeth, like almost like a, what people wear today as a mouthpiece almost, you know. Close your mouth, they would strap your head with gauze bin so you couldn't open your jaws.
And they put this device over the place where the tooth had been?
Well, when they pulled the tooth mm-hmm. out, they would then put the oxycell on the gum, I guess the hole in the gum to try to stop it from bleeding. Mm-hmm. Put the rubber thing over it or something, you know, you'd bite down and they strap your head with gauze so you really couldn't open your jaw. And I'd have to eat liquid for about 2 weeks or so, you know, all kinds of fraps and things or whatever they had at the time. And you weren't supposed to move your mouth at all. I was in bed, you know, you weren't supposed to too much activity or nothing, you know. And they would check the thing every, I don't know how many days or not. Naturally, it would just ooze and ooze. At first, it would bleed so much, and then it would bleed clot. And then as the clot would come off, it would bleed more. And eventually, it would heal over maybe a couple of weeks or so, you know. It was a terrible process, but it was all they knew, you know. It was a lousy taste in your mouth. There was all kinds of probably fungus and everything there, and you'd lose weight and everything naturally because you weren't eating and stuff, you know.
So having a tooth out was a big deal.
It was almost like no such thing, but it had to be done, I guess, so they did it, you know. Today it's a lot different. I mean, I had a tooth out I don't know if it was 10 years ago or not. I infused with my factor. I went to the dentist. I had a tooth out, and then I also had a gum surgery or something a couple of years ago or so. Same thing, you just infuse before you went. The tooth extracted. I went to the office, and it was in Worcester, and I went there. He took it out. There was no bandages, no oxycell, no nothing like that. Just came home. I was taking a pill. Can't think of the name of it now. It's a coagulant too, plus my infusion for the next few days. Went back to work the next day, you know. With the surgery, and I was retired at the time with the surgery here a couple of years ago. He did my gums or whatever it was or something, you know, he impacted it, whatever he had to. I infused and went back to see him in a few days, and, you know, it oozed a little bit for a couple of days or something, and kept on infusing for like the week or whatever it was, and no problem whatsoever, you know.
What a difference.
You know, it's come a long way. It's almost like you having a tooth out, you know, a little bit more cautious, but basically about the same. So you can go to a dentist and have it extracted. Of course, the basic thing is don't let the teeth get that bad and stuff, you know. But yeah, when I was a kid, it was terrible. I think I had it done twice, because I think they had to do one part, and then they had to come back and do a couple of other teeth, but it was...
They did this with gas, did they, in those days? You probably had gas.
I probably did, because I don't know if they
didn't have Novocaine.
Yeah, so. I don't think they wanted to stick needles in you anyway.
I don't think you had it. No.
Now, I haven't had any... too many fillings for a while, but they do use Novocaine to stick mm-hmm. to it. But usually when I go to dentist now, I usually infuse myself before I go. Mm-hmm. And if there isn't any problem when I come back, which there hasn't been, I would infuse myself again, you know. But yeah, any kind of operation was a holocaust back then. I mean, whether it was an appendix. Fortunately, I never had an appendix. Never had shit other than that there. I mean, today I could go and do anything. I mean, any kind of surgery, and, you know, they have their units and everything, and they follow everything up, you know.
What about injections? The normal injections that you had, were they an issue? Childhood injections?
I don't really know. I think I was so young that I don't really know. I really haven't had any injections other than I don't get the flu shot because I never really get too many flu, so I figure leave well enough alone. I don't know if that's a problem with, because that's an intramuscular thing or something.
I didn't know about smallpox, but that's actually just surface. So.
Yeah, I that's such a long time ago. Mm-hmm. When I did have the hepatitis, I had to inject into my stomach here in the soft tissue. But that needle was so small and everything, that was no problem. When you infuse into the vein, you know, so it's a little bit different. But yeah, I guess there's always a fear of needles, but I mean, they draw blood from me and stuff like that, you know, but I really never have any problem with it, you know.
Tell me about the hepatitis C and finding that you had hepatitis and what happened over that process.
Well, I guess I must have contracted it from not the fact that, but from blood transfusions that I had over a period of years or something like that. I don't know if it really, how it infected me growing up or nothing. It was just laying in my system dormant there, but the thing was that it could lay there for the rest of my life. It could erupt sometime and it could affect my life. I was aware of it, but I guess I was saying basically, it's there, what's it going to do, you know? I mean, their concern was that, I guess, if it erupted, it could, you know, cause death and whatever, you know? It was only a mild case, too. It wasn't, I guess they classify it as, like, I don't know if it's 1, 2, and 3. When they were doing my hemophilia clinics or anything, you know, it would always come up, and they knew it was there, and it's, you know, more or less say it's there, and it's Matthew's... he's living with it or something like that. It was just when I changed doctors a few years back to Brigham and Women's, because we figured all these years I've been going out to Worcester, which isn't on the other side of the earth, but it's a little further away, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, they said, well, there's awful good doctors here in Boston that you can go see, you know, and it's geographically it's closer, and I'm getting older and my wife's getting older, and so we decided to come here. When we first came, yeah, I already went through like 3 doctors. The first one was Hewenstein, and he left, and Dr. Marks, he left, and I was saying, is it me, or, you know, should I go back to Worcester? Now we've been with this other doctor, Mandel, I think is his name. I don't see them that often, like it's like about twice a year, you know.
Uh-huh.
And because they're right there in Boston, I can call them and stuff like that if I have a problem, which I don't have many problems, you know. I can't remember the last time I infused. I mean, people will say, when was the last time you infused? I don't infuse every day, and I only infuse when I think I got a bump or a bruise, you know, and I try not to get those, you know. But anyways, it's just when I went to Brigham and Women's, they sent me to see a gynecology,
that's ladies.
Ladies, what's the
gastroenterologist,
yeah, right. You know, they have to do with the kidneys and
that's
stuff
right.
like that and everything, right. And they knew, you know, I had it, and I guess they were running at the time. They had been running surveys and stuff about people with hepatitis C, and they were trying to cure people with this particular drug. Happens to be interferon. Mine was peg interferon, which is a drug that takes medicine that takes care of leukemia. Same medicine, but it works like in different ways. And they sent me to see the doctor, and his name was Grace, Dr. Grace, and he said, you know, that there was a possibility that they could cure it. There was no guarantee of anything. He told me the side effects. There's a lot of side effects from the drug. It kind of zaps all your strength out. You lose your appetite. You lose weight.
Like
you
feel chemotherapy.
Sort of, yeah. You feel fatigued.
Nauseous?
Sometimes. My biggest problems was I lost weight. I lost about 35 to 40 pounds. My appetite was suppressed. I didn't feel like eating. I was very tired. I'd come up a flight of stairs from the basement, and I'd be huffing and puffing. And a couple of times I felt like I had the flu or something like that. But basically, that was the most of it. Some people experience different effects and stuff. I went on to, so anyways, their idea was that it could erupt, it couldn't, not erupt. They said, here I was, I think it was about 68 at the time, and I was saying to them, why do you want to put me on this and cure me for this? Is it a, I'm probably going to die in 10 years or so anyways. And they said, well, that's not the way to look at it. They said that you could, you might live to be 100 if we can cure this or whatever it is,
Why did you think you were going to die in 10
years? Well, I always say people to that. Why fool around with a 7-year-old man when you can get a 7-year-old kid and help him? I mean, my life is pretty well, I feel pretty well, gone. I mean, but it's not true, really. I just kind of joke about that. I could live to be 100, but I usually say, I'm 70. How much longer am I going to live, I was just kind of being a wise guy with something with that, But anyways, they said, if you want to try. So I said, I'll go on it. So I went on a program for about 48 weeks, I think it was.
And how old were you when you did that?
68.
Mm-hmm. Retired.
Yes. And that's another thing. Basically, to go on this program, you'd have to either be retired or take some time off from work at school, because it does exhaust you in a sense. So I only infused once a week. Used to be on Sundays, and it was only a minimal amount. It was called pig interferon, which is the same as with leukemia. I took some pills. I think it was Ribitol or something like that. I took like 5 a day, 2 in the morning, 3 at night, or 3 in the morning, 2 at night, something like that. And after about, they check you, like, after you infuse yourself once a week for 48 weeks. But after, I think it's like the first week or two, you have to go in and see them, and then after that, it's like every second week, and then every third or fourth week. As you get more into the program, it's less and less. But the first, they watch you very closely the very first 3 months of the program, and basically they want to see if there's any changes in your blood and everything, and also if the side effects are causing any problems with you. In my case, after like 3 months, they couldn't even find the virus anymore, and the side effects weren't that great. I was dealing with them, And then after 6 months, they still couldn't find any virus, and I still had the side effects. I was losing more and more weight, because I went from like about 200 down to about 160. They were concerned after about 6 months about the weight. They didn't want me to lose any more weight, just they wanted me to stay like about 160. Actually, they put me on a program with this Ensure and stuff like that, to put, I drank that and everything, but I might have minimized it. I helped a little bit, but I don't really know. But I didn't lose any more weight over the next 6 months. But even after 6 months, they couldn't find the virus. Everything was going fine. I said, I'll struggle with the virus. I mean, the side effects. After 9 months, it was the same thing. No virus, no nothing. Can you handle the side effects? At one time, they thought, possibly they would take me off the program, but then they said, if we already gone 9 months, if we don't go the extra 3 months and it does come back, they might say, well, gee, we went all this way for nothing, we should have stayed. So what they did was they cut my medicine down a little bit for the next 3 months, the last 3 months of the system. It never showed up, it never came back. I gained about 10 pounds or so after I got off the program. I've been off it now for a year and a half to 2 years or something like that. And they can never find the virus. I've had my blood checked, periodically from different doctors. Still can't find it. I don't feel as tired. And I've put some weight on back, but I don't want to put it all back on and stuff like that. So in my case, it worked out good for me, So
it did, didn't it?
Yeah, basically, I'll live to be 100.
Did you have a health policy through your retirement plan that paid for that?
Yeah, we tried to get the drug companies to do it, but we couldn't get that. Fortunately, at the time, I only had to pay, I think it was $15 for the pig interferon and $15 for the Ribitol, which I used to get like a month's supply at a time. So it was costing me about $30 a month, roughly. That was a big issue. If I couldn't get my prescription, my people to pay for it, I wasn't going to go on it unless I could get them to pay for it, a grant or something, because the medicine itself is very expensive. I think it's like something like, I don't know if it's $1,200 just for the one shipment of 4 of Pegatron and another 12 or even more. It's probably about $3,000 or more per month, but it only cost me 30, and naturally I was able to claim that in my taxes and things, so it wasn't a big problem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the cost was a factor.
Oh, it would be a factor.
Yeah.
No, that's a huge amount of money.
Definitely, yeah.
And for something that isn't affecting you.
Yeah, that was
in an overt way.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there any doctor in all of this experience that really stands out for you, or nurse, or somebody who really made a difference for you?
You mean that kind of helped me along the way?
Yeah, not only physically, but...
As a kid growing up, Dr. Bigelow, he was very, very helpful, very knowledgeable. I mean, I can picture the guy. He's a tall, thin Englishman, blonde hair and everything. He was very knowledgeable at the time, because I'm going back a lot of years, you know. Mm-hmm. And he helped my mother and father, which they knew nothing about, and he tried to help us about it and where it came from and everything, stuff like that. And then, of course, as we went along, I believe just recently, in Brigham and Women's Hospital, there was this nurse, Helen Mahoney West, who was she was very, very helpful. I had known her for years, had seen her at a lot of functions and things, and she was kind of always, you know, not begging me to come to Brigham, but she was always saying, you probably should think about it, and they were very good doctors. But she was very helpful at anything we needed. I wasn't even a patient of hers, and I could call her, and she would give me knowledge and information and anything I wanted. Since she's also left, since I went to Brigham once, but that was only because it was a point in her life where she moved on to different things. But she had been with Brigham for the longest time. She was very helpful, and Dr. Bigelow was very helpful. And, you know, I mean, the doctors I have now are good, but they kind of stood out in my life, you know.
Yes.
Not that anybody was bad.
Oh, no, I'm looking for the people who
went
the extra mile with you.
I think they went the extra mile.
And Bigelow, you would have seen at what age? He would have been...
Oh, back about, 40s, 50s, around the 50s, I guess.
Yeah.
He was after Dr. Damashek. I'm not sure what happened to Dr. Damashek. He was the one who diagnosed me, and I don't know why we moved on to Dr. Bigelow, but it would be back about the 50s, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it took a real toll on your mother, or do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure she was... concerned, you know, but I don't think it stressed her out that much. I think she didn't know that much about it too, other than she wanted me to be, don't do anything, just be very, very careful about everything, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a modern day attitude that it isn't fair, and I don't feel that you ever felt that way. It was something that happened.
Oh.
You dealt with it.
You mean...
Well, that you were talking about how differently some of the young people now approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And quite rightly you say, well, it is much easier.
I think it was a case of back then they didn't know much about it, and they kind of just accepted it that it was there, and, you know, they just said, don't do any of this. Today I think the mothers and fathers, a lot of them know about it when they're going in. They know that someone in their family had hemophilia and the girl's going to be a carrier and they have sons. Some don't. There are these people that come up, they say, we have no history or nothing. I don't know how this involves, how it gets it. They're a little more shocked, naturally, because they don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. But people that know their brothers or someone had it, and they, you know, it might be a possibility, they kind of, they deal with it. And it is still a shock, too, because they're hoping, you know, when they have a child, that they're not going to have a hemophiliac boy or something like that, but it's a little easier to deal with, and knowing that it was a possibility and that there are medicines and things today that they can lead normal basic lives, in a sense, you know. Mm-hmm. And there is help out there for them, you know. Not all of them look for it or get it, or a lot of them still, I think, feel that, you know, well, why me? I mean, I knew it was a possibility, but I have a child, and now they're a little resentful, but...
You never were.
Yeah, I guess basically in life, to this day, I say, gee, I wish I never had hemophilia. You know, there's a lot of sports things, and basically a lot of things I probably wanted to do, but I didn't. And I'm probably a little resentful that I got a bad knee and a bad ankle, but that's not their fault. That's my fault, because I didn't infuse myself or take care of myself when I was younger. Mm-hmm. So I guess I have to say slap myself for that. But as far as, naturally, nobody wants to have a disease, mm-hmm. but everybody has something. And
but you dealt with it.
Yeah, I dealt with it more as I got older because I guess you get smarter, Just like anything, you should get a little smarter as you get older. You do, kids that don't have the disease do things today they shouldn't do, and later on in life they say, gee, I did this, I did that. You know, what a jerk I was,
As a child, did you dread the transfusions? Did you dread the hospital part? No child likes needles coming.
I guess I really didn't like to be stuck with needles, and I didn't particularly like transfusions and stuff like that, but...
When you look at the needles they used...
Yeah, they were bigger.
You're looking
and stuff.
At bigger needles. Mm-hmm. I can remember mm-hmm. those. Yeah, it was not a nice experience.
No, it wasn't. Today I don't particularly like needles either. Mm-hmm. Someone always said, I guess somewhere along the line, someone said, when they're going to take blood or anything, stick it with a needle, turn your head so you don't see it. Because when you're watching it, you know exactly when it